moments before the Tyrians set it ablaze and destroyed it. On the left defensive flank, the embattled rear guard fought bravely to hold the other rampway as Acton's command raced still another time within range of the maddened gnome archers, and still more died. It was a running battle all the way, and at one point the horsemen had to charge directly through the center of a thin line of swordsmen that rushed down to cut off their escape. But at last the harried riders reached the haven of the bluff, galloping up the rampway almost without slowing and swinging toward the opened gates of the city, where they were greeted by crowds of cheering soldiers and citizens. As the last of the returning cavalry gained the heights, the rear guard hastily withdrew behind their defenses, and the rampway was hauled to safety. It was midday by this time, and the heat of the noon sun settled like a humid blanket over the men of both armies. In sullen reluctance, the Northland army withdrew from the battle to regroup, dragging with it hundreds of dead and wounded. The smoke from the burning oil hung in an unmoving haze over the strangely silent grasslands as the morning wind faded quietly away. The ground before the bluff face was littered with the charred bodies of the dead, and small fires still burned persistently as the great timbers of the shattered rampways turned slowly to ashes. A foul stench began to rise from the terrible battlefield, and scavengers that flew and crawled appeared with shrill, eager cries to feast. Across the battered land, the armies watched each other with undisguised hatred, weary and racked with pain, but eager to resume the killing that had been thrust upon them. For several long hours, the once green land lay empty beneath the cloudless blue sky as its scarred surface baked and dried in the heat of the summer sun. It began to appear to those who allowed their reason to slip in favor of wishful thinking that the assault had ended, that the destruction was finished. Thoughts turned hopefully from killing and survival to family and loved ones. The shadow of death lifted momentarily. Then in the late hours of the waning afternoon, the Northland army attacked again. As lines of gnome archers showered the low bulwarks and the bluff beyond with a seemingly endless barrage of arrows, large bands of mixed swordsmen, gnome and troll, made sharp rushes at the Southland defenses, trying vainly to discover a weak point. Portable ramps, small scaling ladders, and grappling hooks with knotted ropes, all were tried to force a breach in the legion lines, but each time the attackers were repelled. It was a wearing, vicious assault designed to tire and discourage the men of Tircis. The long day died slowly into dusk, and still the pitched battle wore on. It ended in darkness and tragedy for the Border Legion. As twilight descended on the bloodied land, the weary foes launched a final hail of spears and arrows at each other across the hazy void they could scarcely see through. A stray arrow caught Acton through the throat as the Legion cavalry commander was returning from his command on the left defensive flank, knocking the great fighter from his mount into the reaching arms of his attendants, where he died moments later. The kingdom of the warlock lord was the single most desolate, forbidding piece of country in the known world, a barren, lifeless ring of impassable death traps. The tender, life-giving hand of nature had long since been driven from this thankless domain of darkness, and the wilderness that remained lay wrapped in silence. Its eastern borders were mired in the gloom and fetid stench of the vast Malg swamp, a dismal, sprawling bog that no living creature had ever successfully traversed. Beneath the shallow waters, on which floated loose patches of colorless weeds that grew and died in the span of a day, the earth had turned to mud and quicksand, and all that came within its grip were sucked quickly from sight. The Malg was said to be bottomless, and while scattered throughout its vast expanse, small bits of solid earth and great skeletal limbs of dying trees could still be glimpsed, even these were fading one by one. Across the far northern stretches, extending westward from the Malg, was a rambling series of low-backed mountains, appropriately named the Razors. There were no passes through these mountains, and their wide, sloped backs were craggy, jutting slabs of rock, seemingly pushed upward from the bowels of the earth. An experienced and determined climber might still have found the Razors passable. One or two men had even made the attempt, had it not been for the particularly venomous species of spider that nested in vast numbers throughout the barren mountains. The bleached bones of the dead, scattered in small white patches among the darkened rocks, gave mute testimony to their unavoidable presence. There was a break in the deadly ring where the Razors tapered off into foothills at the northwest corner of the kingdom, and for over 5 miles southward the country was easily passable, opening directly into the center of the circle of barriers. Here there was no natural protection against intruders, but this small gateway to the interior of the kingdom was also the obvious approach, and hence the trap door to the cage through which the Lord and Master waited for the unwary to step. Eyes and ears responsive only to his command guarded the narrow strip of land carefully. The ring could be locked instantly. Directly below the foothills, a vast, arid wasteland called the Kirlak Desert ran southward for nearly 50 miles. A heavy, poisonous vapor hung invisibly over the sprawling, sand-covered plains, drawn from the waters of the River Lethe, a venomous stream that wound lazily into the fiery emptiness from the south and emptied into a small lake in the interior. Even birds, chancing to fly too close to the deadly haze, were killed in seconds. Creatures dying in the terrible furnace of sand and poisonous air decayed in a matter of hours and turned to dust, so that nothing remained to show their passing. But the most formidable barrier of all stretched menacingly across the southern boundary of the forbidden domain, beginning at the southeasterly edges of the Kirlak Desert and running eastward to the marshy borders of the Malg Swamp. The Knife Edge. Like great stone spears driven into the hard earth by some monstrous giant, these mountains towered thousands of feet into the sky. They had the appearance not so much of mountains as a series of awesome peaks jutting in broken lines that blocked the dim horizon like fingers stretching painfully. At their base swirled the toxic waters of the River Lethe, which had its origin in the Malg Swamp and meandered westward at the base of the Great Rock Barrier to disappear into the impregnable vapors of the Kirlak Desert. Only a man driven by an unexplainable madness would have attempted to scale the Knife Edge. There was a passage through the barrier, a small, winding canyon that opened onto a series of craggy foothills which ran for several thousand yards to the base of a single, ominously solitary mountain just within the southern boundary of the ring. The scarred surface of this mountain was chipped and worn by time and the elements, lending the southern facing a singularly menacing appearance. On even the most casual inspection, one was immediately struck by the frightening similarity the south wall bore to a human skull, stripped of flesh and life, the pate rounded and gleaming above the empty sockets of the eyes, the cheeks sunken, and the jaw a crooked line of bared teeth and bone. This was the home of the Lord and Master. This was the kingdom of Brona, the warlock lord. Everywhere it bore the stamp of the skull, the indelible mark of death. It was midday, but time seemed strangely suspended, and the vast, wasted fortress lay wrapped in a peculiar stillness. The familiar grayness screened the sun and sky, and the drab, brownish terrain of rock and earth lay stripped of mortal life. Yet there was something more in the air this day, cutting through the silence and the emptiness to the flesh and blood of the men in the winding column, passing through the single gateway and the massive knife edge. It was the pressing sense of urgency that hung poised over the blasted face of the kingdom of the Warlock Lord, as if events to come had rushed through time too quickly, and jammed together in eager anticipation, waited for their moment. The trolls shuffled guardedly through the twisting canyon, their comparatively huge frames dwarfed by the towering heights of the peaks, so that they appeared little more than ants in the sprawling, ageless rock. They entered the kingdom of the dead the way in which little children enter an unfamiliar dark room, inwardly frightened, hesitant, but nevertheless determined to see what lay beyond. They marched unchallenged, though not unseen. They were expected. Their appearance came as no surprise, and they entered without danger of harm from the minions of the Master. Their impassive faces disguised their true intentions, or they would never have passed the southern shores of the River Lethe. For in their midst was the last of a bloodline the Spirit King had thought destroyed, the last son of the Elven House of Shannara. Shay marched directly behind the broad frame of Kel'Thuzet, his hands seemingly tied at his back. Panamon Creel followed, his arms similarly bound, the gray eyes dangerous as they stared watchfully at the great rock walls on either side of the winding column. The ruse had worked perfectly. Apparent captives of the rock trolls, the two Southlanders had been marched to the shores of the River Lethe, the sluggish, vile stream that flanked the southernmost borders of the Skull Kingdom. The trolls and their silent charges had bordered a wide-backed raft of rotted wood and rusted iron spikes, whose voiceless captain was a bent, hooded creature who seemed more beast than man, his face shielded in the folds of the musty black cloak, but his hooked, scale-covered hands clearly visible as they fastened tightly on the crooked leverage pole and guided the ancient craft across the tepid, poison waters. The uneasy passengers felt a growing sense of revulsion from the mere presence of their pilot and were openly relieved when, after finally permitting them to disembark on the far shore, he vanished with his ancient barge into the haze that lay across the dark river waters. The lower Northland was now entirely lost to them, the grayness so heavily disseminated through the stale, dry air that nothing beyond the river was visible. In contrast, the soaring, blackened cliffs of the knife edge loomed starkly before them, the great fingers of rock brushing the mist aside in the half-light of the northern midday. The party passed wordlessly through the corridor that split the vast heights, winding deeper into the forbidden domain of the Warlock Lord. The Warlock Lord. Somehow Shay felt that he had known from the very beginning, from the day Alanon had told him of his remarkable ancestry, that it would happen this way. That circumstances would demand he face this awesome creature who was trying so desperately to destroy him. Time and events merged into a single instant, a flash of jumbled memories of the long days spent in flight, running to stay alive, running toward this frightening confrontation. Now the moment was drawing near, and he would face it virtually alone in the most savage land in the known world. His oldest, most trusted friends scattered, his only companions a band of rock trolls, an outcast thief, and a vengeful, enigmatic giant. The latter had persuaded the tribunal to place under his command a detachment of troll warriors, not so much because they believed that the insignificant veilman accompanying him somehow possessed the ability to destroy the immortal Brona, as because their massive kinsman was the holder of the honored Black Iryx. The three judges had also revealed the fates of Oral Fane. The trolls had seized the little fugitive about an hour before his determined pursuers had been taken captive, and he had been marched under guard to the main encampment. The Matarin tribunal had quickly concluded that the gnome was completely mad. He had babbled insanely to them of secrets and treasures, his wizened yellow face contorted in a hideous fixed grin. At times he had appeared to be talking to the air about him, brushing violently at his bare arms and legs as if living things had fastened there. His sole link with reality seemed to be the ancient sword that was his only possession, the sword he clung to so violently that his captors could not pry it free. They allowed him to keep the worthless piece of metal, binding his clenched yellow hands to its rusted sheath. Within the hour he was taken north to the dungeons of the warlock lord. The canyon wound wickedly through the towering peaks of the knife edge, at times dwindling from a broad trailway to little more than a split in the rocks. The burly trolls scrambled through the twisting passage without resting. A few had been there before, and they led the others at a steady, tiring pace. Speed was essential. If they delayed too long, the Spirit King would hear that Oral Fane and the ancient weapon he refused to release, even for the briefest moment, were safely shut away in the warlock lord's own dungeons. Shay shuddered at the possibility. It might already have happened. They could be walking straight to their own execution. Each time before, on the long journey from Cullhaven, the warlock lord had seemed to know every move they had made. Each time he had been waiting for them. It was madness, this terrible risk. And even if they did succeed, even if Shay finally held the Sword of Shannara within his grasp, why, what then? Shay laughed inwardly. Could he face the warlock lord without Alanon beside him? Without any idea what would trigger the hidden power of the legendary talisman? No one would even know he had the sword. The Veilman had no idea what the others intended, but he had already determined that if by some miracle he could get his hands on the elusive weapon, he was going to run for his life. Everyone else could do as he wished. He was certain that Panamon Creel would have approved of the plan, but the two had scarcely exchanged 10 words since the journey to the Skull Kingdom had begun. Shay sensed that for the first time in Panamon's life, a life composed primarily of narrow escapes and hair-raising escapades, the scarlet-clad thief was frightened. But he had gone with Kel'Thuzet and Shay. Gone because they were his only friends. Gone because his pride would let him do no less. His most basic instinct was to survive at any cost, but he would not permit himself to be shamed, even to stay alive. Kel'Thuzet's reasons for this dangerous undertaking were less apparent. Shay thought he understood why the giant troll had quietly insisted that they must retrieve the Sword of Shannara, and it was much more than personal vengeance for the slaughter of his family. There was something about Kel'Thuzet that reminded Shay of Balinor, a quiet confidence that lent strength to those less certain. Shay had felt it when Kel'Thuzet indicated that they must go after Oral Fane and the sword. Those gentle, intelligent eyes told the Veilman that he believed in him, and while Shay could not explain it in rational terms, he knew he had to go with his giant friend. If he turned away now, after the long weeks spent searching for the sword of Shannara, he would be betraying both his friends and himself. The cliff walls on either side fell away abruptly, and the canyon opened into a sloping valley that seemed like a wide depression in the rugged interior of the Skull Kingdom, its surface barren and dry, the earth broken by a scattering of rocky hillocks and dry riverbeds. The party halted silently, every pair of eyes involuntarily drawn to the solitary mountain in the bowl of the little valley, the southern face staring sightlessly at them from two huge, empty sockets that resembled the eyes of a skull. The blasted face waited in timeless anticipation for the coming of the master. Standing at the mouth of the draw, Shay felt the hair on the back of his neck rise, and a sudden chill surge through his small frame. From out of the rocks to either side, a number of misshapen, lumbering creatures shuffled, their great bodies as drab as the dying land, their faces nearly featureless. Once they might have been human, but they were no longer so. They stood upright on two legs, and two arms swung aimlessly at their sides, but the resemblance ended there. Their skin was the texture of chalky putty, almost rubbery in appearance, and they moved in the manner of mindless beings. Like apparitions out of some frightening nightmare, the strange creatures came all around the trolls, staring blankly into their bark-like faces as if to be certain of what manner of creatures had come to them. Keltset turned slightly and motioned to Panamon Creel. "The trolls call them mutants," the adventurer whispered quietly. "Stand easy. Remember that you were supposed to be a prisoner. Stay calm." One of the misshapen beings spoke in rasping tones to the lead trolls, gesturing briefly at the two bound men. There was a short exchange, and then one of the trolls said something over his shoulder to Keltset, who immediately motioned for Shay and Panamon to follow him. The trio detached themselves from the main group. Accompanied by two other trolls, they silently followed one of the lumbering mutants as he turned and moved rather unsteadily toward the inner cliff wall to their left. Shay glanced back once and observed the trolls scattering idly to either side of the canyon entrance, seemingly waiting for their companions to return. The remaining mutants had not moved. Looking ahead once more, the veilman saw that the cliff face was split by a long fissure that ran several hundred feet up, and that this gap was a passage to something beyond. The little group moved into the rock wall, their eyes trying to adjust to the sudden darkness. There was a pause as their guide took a torch from a wall rack and lit it, handing it absently to one of the trolls before proceeding. Apparently his own eyes were accustomed to the inky darkness, for he continued to lead them. The party passed into a dank, foul-smelling cavern that branched out into several fathomless passageways. From somewhere far away, Shay thought he detected the faint, chilling sound of screams, ringing over and over as echoes against the rock walls. Panamon cursed harshly in the flickering torchlight, his broad face streaked with sweat. The silent, heedless mutant shuffled ahead into one of the passages, and the faint light from the fissure opening faded into blackness. The lingering echo of booted feet on rock was the only sound as the men moved down the darkened corridor, their eyes wandering briefly to the windowless iron doors bolted into the face of the rock on both sides of the passageway. The screams still rang faintly in their ears, but they seemed more distant now. There were no human sounds from the cells they were passing. Finally, the guide halted before one of the heavy doors, gesturing briefly and speaking in the same guttural tones to the trolls. He turned to continue down the passage and had taken his first step when the foremost troll brought his great iron mace crashing down on the creature's bulky head. The mutant dropped lifelessly to the cave floor. Keltset moved to loosen the ropes binding Shay and Panamon as the two remaining trolls stood watchfully before the cell door. When his friends were freed, the massive Northlander moved cat-like to the iron door and slid the latches clear of their loops. Grasping the bars, he pulled on the ancient door. With a sharp grating sound, the heavy portal swung open. "Now we shall see," breathed Panamon harshly. Taking the light from Keltset, he stepped cautiously into the tiny room, his two companions close behind. Oral Fane sat hunched against the far wall, his scrawny legs shackled in chains that were bolted into the rock flooring, his clothing torn and dirtied almost beyond recognition. He was clearly not the same creature they had captured several days earlier on the plains of Strelaheim. He stared at the three faces with mindless disregard, his thin yellow face fixed in a hideous grin as he babbled meaninglessly to himself. His eyes were strangely dilated in the bright torchlight, and he glanced all about as he talked, behaving as if there were others in the little cell, creatures invisible to all eyes but his own. The two men and the giant troll took in his condition at a glance, their eyes traveling instantly to the bony hands that still clutched possessively the battered leather and metal scabbard that sheathed the elusive object of their long pursuit. The ancient hilt flickered back dully in the torchlight, giving them a shadowy image of the raised hand holding the burning torch. They had found it. They had found the sword of Shannara. For a moment, no one moved as the maddened gnome clutched the sword closer to his emaciated frame, his eyes showing a momentary flicker of recognition as he caught sight of the sharp pike glinting at the stumped end of Panamon's slowly raising arm. The adventurer stepped forward menacingly and bent close to the gnome's thin face. "I've come for you, gnome," he said harshly. Oral Fane seemed to undergo a sudden transformation at the sound of Panamon Creel's voice, and a frightened shriek escaped his lips as he struggled to move farther back. "Give me the sword, you treacherous rat," the thief demanded. Without waiting for a response, he seized the weapon, trying to wrest it from the now thoroughly terrified gnome's astonishingly strong grip. But even with death staring him directly in the eye, Oral Fane would not give up his precious possession. His voice rose to a scream, and in sudden fury, Panamon brought the heavy iron binding on his piked hand down across the little fellow's unprotected skull. The gnome crumpled unconscious to the cold floor. "All those days we chased this miserable creature," Panamon cried. He stopped abruptly and lowered his voice to a harsh whisper. "I thought I would at least have the pleasure of watching him die, but it's no longer worth it." In disgust, he reached for the hilt of the sword, intent on drawing it from its binding, but Keltset stepped forward and placed a restraining hand on his shoulder. Still angered, the thief stared back coldly as the rock troll motioned silently toward the watching Shay. Then both stepped back. The sword of Shannara was Shay's birthright. But he hesitated. He had come so far, been through so much, all for this moment. And now he found himself afraid. He felt cold inside as he looked at the ancient weapon. For an instant he considered refusing, knowing that a part of him could not accept the awesome responsibility that he was being asked to assume, a responsibility that had been forced on him. He recalled in a flash the terrible power of the three Elfstones. What then of the power of the Sword of Shannara? In his mind, he pictured the faces of Flick and Menion and the others who had fought so hard to gain possession of the sword for him. If he turned away now, he would have betrayed the trust they had extended him. In effect, he would be telling them that everything they had gone through for him had been pointless. He saw again the dark, enigmatic face of Al-Anon chastising him for his foolish ideals, his refusal to see men for what they were. He would have to answer to him as well. And Al-Anon would not be pleased. Woodenly, he moved to the fallen Orophane and bent over him, his fingers closing firmly around the cold metal hilt of the weapon, feeling the raised image of the burning torch in his sweating palm. He paused. Then slowly, he drew forth the Sword of Shannara. Chapter 32. The second day of the battle for Tirsis bore witness to the same wholesale slaughter of the men of the Northland army as the first. The giant invasion force attacked at dawn, marching toward the face of the bluff in precision formation to the deep booming of the gnome war drums, pausing in silence within 100 yards. Then, with an ear-shattering yell, the army rushed headlong into the terrible struggle to gain the heights. With the same utter disregard for their own lives, the attackers threw themselves in wave after wave against the outer defenses of the entrenched Border Legion. They came without the aid of the monstrous rampways, which there had been no time to rebuild, relying instead on thousands of small scaling ladders and grappling irons. It was a ferocious, merciless, and bitter contest. Hundreds of the Northlanders died in the first few minutes. With Acton gone, Balinor did not choose to risk the Legion-mounted command a second time in counterattacking the massive enemy army. He decided instead to dig in on the bluff face and hold his position as long as possible. Burning oil and the Legion archers shredded the first waves of the assault, but this time the attackers did not break apart and run. They came in an endless, sustained charge, finally eluding both arrows and flames to reach the base of the wide plateau where scaling ladders were thrown against the bluff. Swarms of screaming Northlanders struggled upward, and the fighting was reduced to basic hand-to-hand combat. For nearly 8 hours, the valiant defenders of Tirsis repelled an enemy 20 times its size. Scaling ladders and grappling hooks were methodically shattered and cut apart. Northlanders were pushed away as quickly as they gained the summit, and momentary holes in the defense lines were closed before a breach could be opened. The acts of bravery performed by individual members of the famed Legion were too numerous to recount. They fought against impossible odds, without rest, without relief, knowing all the while that no quarter would be given them by the enemy should they fail. For 8 hours, the enraged Northland army struggled to break through the Legion bulwarks without success. But finally, a breach was opened on the defensive left flank. With a ragged shout of victory, the enemy rushed onto the bluff. After the death of Acton, the aged Fandwick had been left in sole command of this section of the defensive lines. Calling on his diminished reserves, the Legion commander moved to block the Northland rush. An intense, fierce battle raged in the open breach for long minutes as the determined attackers battled to hold and enlarge the newly gained opening. Dozens died on both sides, including the valiant Fandwick. Balinor rushed more reserves from the center of the line in an effort to close the breach, and he finally succeeded. But moments later a second and then a third hole opened in the left defensive flank, and the whole command began to waver and break apart. The King of Callahorn realized his army could no longer hold the outer defenses and passed the word to his remaining commanders to begin an orderly retreat into the city. Rallying the crumbling left flank, the giant borderman drew in his outermost defenses while holding the enemy at bay and quickly moved the entire command into the city. It was a bitter moment for the Southlanders, who now rushed to defend the great outer wall. But the Northland army did not advance to the attack. Instead, they began tearing down the defensive bulwarks and moving them inward on the bluff face, where they constructed their own defensive position, just out of range of the Legion archers. The weary soldiers of the Border Legion watched silently from atop the city walls as the sunlit afternoon turned slowly to dusk above the busy invaders. The Northland camp was moved forward to the plains below the city, and the army began to light its watchfires as darkness closed in around them. In the final moments of daylight, the enemy revealed a portion of its plan to scale the walls of Tirsis. Great, sloping rampways from the plains to the bluff were hurriedly set in place, supported by stone and timber over the remains of the shattered walkways. Then, from out of the twilight, three massive siege towers rolled into view, each one easily the height of the outer wall. The towers were moved to the rear of the enemy encampment within plain view of the city and anchored for the night. It was clearly a piece of psychological warfare designed to unnerve the besieged Border Legion. From above the gates to the city, Balinor watched impassively with his Legion commanders and his companions from Cullhaven. He toyed briefly with the idea of a night assault against the encamped Northlanders for the express purpose of burning the siege towers, but quickly discarded it. They would expect him to try something like that, and the city gates would undoubtedly be under careful watch the entire night. Besides, it would be no problem for the Legion to set fire to these towers as easily as they had fired the rampways, once they were moved to the attack. Balinor shook his head and frowned. There was something very wrong about the whole Northland attack concept, but he couldn't put his finger on it. Surely they must be aware that the siege towers would never enable them to breach the city's outer wall. They had to have something else in mind. He wondered for the 100th time whether the elven army would reach the beleaguered city in time. He could not believe that Eventine would fail them. It was dark now, and after ordering a double watch on all sectors of the wall, he invited the men with him to share dinner. Concealed in a grove of trees on the summit of a low ridge several miles west of Tirsis, a small band of horsemen surveyed the carnage of the terrible battle below them as evening settled in. They watched silently as the huge siege towers were wheeled into position at the rear of the Northland army for the morning assault on the fortress city. "We should get a message to them," John Lynsander whispered quietly. "Balinor will want to know that our army is on its way." Flick glanced expectantly at the bandaged figure of Eventine. The strange eyes seemed to burn as he studied the besieged city. "I trust the army is on its way," the elven king muttered almost inaudibly. "Breen has been gone almost 3 days. If he has not returned by tomorrow, I'll go myself." His friend placed an understanding hand on the king's good shoulder. "You are in no condition to travel, Eventine. Your brother will not fail you. Balinor is a seasoned fighter, and the walls of Tirsis have never been breached by an invader in the lifetime of the city. The Legion can defend long enough." There was a long moment of silence. Flick looked back at the darkened city and wondered if his friends were all right. Menyon must be inside those walls, too. The Highlander could not know what had befallen Flick, nor what had happened to Eventine. Nor, for that matter, what had become of the unpredictable Alanon, who for no apparent reason at all had disappeared shortly after the Veilman's return with the elven search party. While the druid had been purposely vague about a great many things since his appearance in Shady Vale, he had never gone off without an explanation. Perhaps he had spoken with Eventine. "The city is encircled and guarded," Eventine's voice broke out of the growing darkness. "It would be extremely difficult to get past their lines even long enough to get a message to Balinor. But you're right, John Lynn. He should know we have not forgotten him." We don't have a large enough force to break through to Tirsis or even to strike the rear guard of the Northlanders, his friend declared thoughtfully. But, he looked quickly at the dark bulk of the siege towers standing deserted on the plains below. A small gesture, finished the king, meaningfully. It was not yet midnight when Balinor was hurriedly summoned to the watchtower above the gates to the city. Moments later he stood speechless on the ramparts in the company of Hendel, Menyon, Durin, and Dale, and stared down upon the chaos spreading through the half-wakened enemy camp. To the rear of the sprawling encampment, the centermost of the three giant siege towers, was a burning pyre that lit the grasslands for miles. Frantic Northlanders rushed wildly over the timbers of the adjoining towers, desperately trying to prevent the flames from spreading. It was obvious that the invader had been taken completely by surprise. Balinor looked at the others and smiled wryly. Help was not so distant after all. The morning of the third day dawned with a sullen stillness that hung shroud-like over the land of Calahorn and the armies of the north and south. Gone was the mighty crashing of the gnome drums, the muffled thudding of booted feet marching to the battle, and the thunderous yells of attack. The sun rose fiery red in the distant east, the dark hue spreading across the fading night like blood. A deep haze clouded the dew-covered face of the land. There was a complete absence of movement, of sound. On the walls of Tirsis, the soldiers of the Border Legion waited nervously, their eyes peering blankly into the gloom for signs of the enemy. Balinor was in command of the center section of the outer wall. Jinison held the right and Messaline the left. Jonas Senpre again commanded the city garrison and the reserves. Menyon, Hendel, and the Elven brothers stood silently at Balinor's side and shivered in the cold of early morning. They had rested poorly, but they felt unusually alert and strangely calm. They had quietly accepted their situation during the past 48 hours. They had seen men die by the thousands, and their own lives seemed almost insignificant compared to the terrible carnage that had engulfed this ancient land, yet very precious at the same time. The grasslands beneath the city were torn and rutted, the earth discolored with blood and littered with death. There was nothing to look forward to but more of the same, and still more, until one army or the other was destroyed. Forgotten for all the defenders of Tirsis was the moral purpose behind the word survival. War had become a mechanical reflex that served as its own excuse for the acts men performed. The blood red of the morning sun grew sharper, and now the shapes of men and horses came into focus as the Northland army was rediscovered, a maze of carefully drawn formations spread all across the expanse of yesterday's battlefield from the bluff defenses to beyond the charred timbers of two fallen siege towers. They did not move. They did not speak. They simply waited. Hendel recognized what was happening and whispered hurriedly to Balinor. Swiftly, the Legion commander sent runners along the walls to his subordinates, warning them of what was expected, cautioning them to keep their soldiers calm and in place. Menyon was about to ask what was happening when suddenly there was movement on the bluff immediately below the city gates. A single armored warrior walked slowly out of the gloom, tall, erect, to stand before the giant wall. In one hand he carried a long staff with a single red pennant. With slow, deliberate movements he planted the pole in the earth, then stepped back ceremoniously, turned, and strode back into his lines. Again there was a moment of complete silence. The long, low, wailing cry of a distant horn sounded mournfully across the plains. Once, twice, a third time, then silence. The Death Watch, Hendel broke the stillness with a hushed whisper. It means we're to be given no quarter. They intend to kill us all. The air was rent violently by the sudden crashing of gnome war drums, and everyone began moving at once. With a rush, thousands of gnome arrows filled the sky, sweeping downward to the ramparts of the city walls. Spears, pikes, and maces flew upward from charging Northlanders. Out of the haze of the plains below appeared the bulk of the one remaining siege tower, groaning and creaking with its own ponderous weight as hundreds of the enemy pulled and pushed the towering monster up the newly constructed rampway toward the outer wall. From within the city, legion archers fired down upon the darting forms of their attackers as the balance of the men of the border legion hugged the stone of the defenses and waited for Balinor's order. The giant borderman waited until the massive siege tower was within 25 yards of the wall. Already the enemy was attempting to scale the great barrier with grappling hooks and ladders, and the rough stone was dotted with clinging figures vainly scrambling toward the summit. Abruptly the cauldrons of oil poured downward from the ramparts, splashing over man and machine alike to saturate the bluff face immediately below. Burning torches followed, and instantly the entire front of the Northland assault force was engulfed in flames. The siege tower and the men around it simply disappeared as the black smoke billowed skyward, blotting out for the legion defenders the carnage below them, but not the shrieks of terror and agony. The attackers attempting to scale the outer wall were trapped. A few managed to reach the ramparts where they were quickly dispatched, but most simply lost their hold or were overcome by the heavy smoke and dropped, screaming, into the fire. Within minutes, the assault was broken and the entire Northland army had again completely disappeared from view. The men on the ramparts peered watchfully into the swirling smoke, vainly trying to discover what form the next assault would take. Balinor looked at his companions and shook his head doubtfully. That was utter foolishness. They must have known what would happen. Yet they came ahead anyway. Are they mad? Perhaps they did it to confuse us, muttered Hendel quietly. Like the smoke screen we so obligingly provided them with. All that dying, just to get a smoke screen, Menyon exclaimed incredulously. If so, then they have something very definite in mind, something they are certain cannot fail, declared Balinor. Keep an eye on things here. I'm going down to the gates. He turned away abruptly and disappeared down the winding stone stairway almost at a run. The others watched him go without comment and turned back to the wall. In front of them, thick clouds of the heavy black smoke still rose skyward as the oil on the plains continued to burn. The cries of death had ceased, and there was a strange silence. What are they up to? Menyon voiced the question at last. For a moment there was no response at all. I wish we had been able to catch Stenman, Durin muttered at last. I haven't felt safe even behind these walls with that madman running loose somewhere in the city. We almost had him, Dale interjected quickly. We followed him into that room, but he seemed to disappear into thin air. There must have been a secret passage. Durin nodded in agreement, and the conversation dropped off again. Menyon stared into the smoke and thought about Shurl waiting for him at the palace, about Shay, Flick, his father, and his homeland, all in a rush of images that flooded his wandering mind. How was it all going to end for them? Shades! Hendel jerked him around so sharply that he was momentarily startled. I've been a fool! Was right in front of me all the time. A secret passage. In the basement of the palace beneath the wine cellar. In the dungeon sealed off all these years. A passageway that leads through the mountains to the plain beyond. The old king spoke of it once to me years and years ago. Stenman must know of it. Away into the city, exclaimed Minion. They'll catch us with our backs to them. He paused sharply. Hendel, Shurl's back there. We don't have much time. Hendel was already starting down the steps. Minion, come with me. Dale, find Janus Senpre and tell him to get help to us at the palace immediately. Durin, find Balinor and warn him. Hurry now, and pray we are not too late. They were down the worn stairs in a rush, scattering across the barracks ground as if possessed. Hendel and Minion broke into a dead run, pushing their way heedlessly through clusters of soldiers toward the gates to the Tirzian Way. Too slow, Minion's harried brain screamed at him. He nearly jerked Hendel off his feet in an effort to turn him toward a small group of saddled reserve mounts tethered to their right. Knocking an interfering attendant aside without pausing, the duo leaped into the saddles of the two nearest mounts and wheeled them toward the city. At a gallop, the horses tore through the open gateway, past the flustered guards, past swarms of reserves posted just inside the gates. With the path cleared, they raced at breakneck speed for the palace. Everything that followed seemed to come in a rush that negated time and space. People and buildings flashed by them in a blur as the two horsemen galloped over the ancient stones of the Tirzian Way. Precious moments were lost, and then the wide arc of the Bridge of Sendik loomed in the distance, spanning the People's Park to the Palace of the Buckhannas. A train of baggage carts scattered wildly at the foot of the bridge as the two riders tore past them without slowing, racing their mounts across the stone arch toward the open gates of the monarchical home. Dashing into the garden-ringed courtyard, Hendel and Minion drew their sweating horses up sharply and vaulted to the ground. Everything was silent. Nothing seemed amiss. A single attendant strolled almost leisurely out of the shadows of a great willow to take the reins from the heated riders, his eyes reflecting only mild curiosity. Hendel gave the man a sharp glance and dismissed him, beckoning Minion after him as he moved hurriedly toward the front doors. Still nothing. Maybe they were in time. Maybe they were even mistaken. The hallways of the ancestral manor loomed empty and silent as the two searchers paused once more in the foyer, casting quick glances at open doorways and deep alcoves, drawn tapestries and curtained windows. Minion turned to find Shurl, but his companion stopped him with a word. The red-haired daughter of kings would have to wait. Slowly now, on cat's feet, the little man led the anxious Highlander down the opposite passageway toward the cellar door. At the bend in the corridor, they hesitated, then flattening themselves against the polished woodwork, peered cautiously around the corner. The massive, iron-bound door to the now familiar wine cellar stood ajar. In the open entryway, three armed men kept watch over the vacant hall. All bore the insignia of the Falcon. Minion and Hendel drew back silently. For the first time, the Prince of Lee realized he was unarmed. He had left the Sword of Lee hanging from the saddle pommel of his horse. Quickly he scanned the hall behind him, his eyes coming to rest at last on a set of crossed pikes fastened to the far wall. A pike was hardly the weapon he needed, but he had no other choice. Noiselessly, he retrieved one unwieldy lance and rejoined Hendel. A long look passed between them. They would have to be quick. If the cellar door were to be closed and fastened from within before they could reach it, they would have lost their chance at Stenman and the passageway. In any event, they were only two. How many more of the enemy awaited them below? They didn't stop to consider it further. In a sudden rush, they were out of hiding and down the hallway. The three guards barely had time to look around before their attackers were upon them. Minion shoved his lance through the man nearest the doorway and was on top of the second a moment later. The final guard dropped soundlessly before Hendel's great mace. It was over almost before it had started, and the two fighters were through the cellar entryway, charging down the worn stone steps to meet the most deadly battle of their lives. The ancient wine cellar was ablaze with torchlight. The small fires seemed to burn from every wall, cutting through the musty darkness like hazy sunlight in early morning. In the center of the vast chamber, the great stone trap door that led to the forgotten dungeons below was thrown open, and from out of the darkness of the pit came the distant sounds of metal striking stone. The cellar was swarming with armed men, and they came at the two intruders from all directions. Hendel and Menyon met the rush with a ferocious counter-assault that carried them into the very midst of their assailants. The Highlander had retrieved a sword from one of the fallen guards at the top of the stairway. Standing back to back with Hendel, he began to cut away the number of his attackers. From the corner of his eye, he saw a familiar scarlet-robed figure emerging from the black pit of the dungeon. At the sight of the hated Stenman, the Prince of Lee felt a savage rage well up inside. With renewed fury, he charged into the enemy guards, trying to cut through their ranks and reach the man who had betrayed them. An unmistakable look of fear crossed the mystic's lean features as he shrank from the terrible battle. Back to back, the dwarf and the Highlander fought as if they had gone mad. Men lay dead and dying all about them. Both were wounded in a dozen places, but they didn't feel the pain. Twice Menyon had slipped on the bloodied floor and gone down, and each time Hendel had driven off the attackers while the Highlander scrambled back to his feet. Only five of the enemy were still standing, but Hendel and Menyon Lee were nearly finished. They fought like mechanical creatures now, their bodies soaked in blood and sweat, their limbs leaden and nerveless. As if suddenly regaining his wits, the terrified Stenman raced to the edge of the pit and began screaming for help. The Prince of Lee responded instantly. With a final burst of strength, he crashed into two of his attackers, knocking both sprawling. A third rushed to stop him, but the charging Highlander put his sword into the man up to the hilt and left it there. Grasping a fallen lance, he pounced upon the cringing mystic and stunned him with a sweeping blow from the great weapon. As the lean frame crumpled to the stone floor, Menyon Lee gripped the edges of the heavy trapdoor and heaved upward with the last of his fading strength. It was as if the stone had been chained in open position to the cellar floor. It did not move. From far below, the sounds of metal on stone ceased, replaced by the thudding of booted feet as men raced toward the trapdoor. Only seconds remained. If they reached the stairs, Menyon was a dead man. Bracing himself, the wounded man again threw all of his weight into lifting the massive piece of stone, and this time it rose. Groaning with the terrible strain, the Highlander raised upward against the great trapdoor until at last it came over and fell with a great booming thud into place in the ancient floor. With numb, sweating hands, he bound the chain through the ceiling rings and fastened it with an iron bar. The passageway was closed. If the Northland army sought entrance here, they would have to cut their way through several feet of stone and iron. Menyon. The sound of his name broke the sudden silence in a cracked whisper. The Highlander had fallen to his hands and knees, but his groping hand found a discarded sword and he raised his battered face. Across a floor littered with a tangled mass of fallen enemy guards, their twisted bodies either lifeless or in their final death throes, the eyes of the Prince of Lee found his friend. The dwarf stood with his back to the wall near the bottom of the cellar stairway, the great mace still gripped tightly in one hand. There were dead bodies all about him. He had killed them all. No one had escaped. The hardened eyes met Menyon's for just an instant, and it was as if they were again meeting for the first time in the lowlands beyond the Black Oaks. He was the old Hendel. Taciturn, grim-faced, ever resourceful. Then the maze slipped from his hand. His eyes glazed over. With a long sigh, his body slid slowly, lifelessly to the death that had finally claimed him. Hendel. The name raced through Menyon's stunned, disbelieving mind as he struggled numbly to his feet and stood swaying unsteadily in the flickering shadows. Tears welled into his reddened eyes and ran in dark streams down his battered face. With leaden steps, he picked his way over the lifeless bodies of the enemy dead, gasping now in unrestrained fury and helplessness. He was only dimly aware of Stenman regaining consciousness somewhere behind him. He reached the dwarf's side and knelt beside him, gently cradling the limp form next to his breast. How many times had Hendel saved his life? How many times had he saved them all, only to... He couldn't finish the thought. He could only cry. Everything seemed to break inside of him at once. Stenman raised himself slowly to one knee and stared blankly about the cellar at the mass of tangled corpses. His men all dead, the stone trap door closed and chained, and fear surged up inside his pain-racked body. One of the intruders was still alive. The Highlander. He hated that man. Hated him so badly he fleetingly considered trying to kill him. But then the fear returned even stronger than before, and abruptly his thoughts turned to escape. Escape so that he could live. There was only one way out. Up the stairs, past the kneeling man, and through the open cellar door. Already he was on his feet, moving noiselessly through the carnage, half walking, half slinking toward the unguarded steps. The Highlander's back was turned to him, still holding the body of the dwarf. Sweat beads broke out on Stenman's forehead and the thin lips curled menacingly. Yet it was fear that kept him moving. Only a few more steps. He would be free again. The city was doomed. All of them would die. All of his enemies. But he would survive. He had to fight down the sudden impulse to laugh aloud. One hand touched the stone of the ancient stairway. One foot followed. The Highlander was only feet away, still unsuspecting. The outer cellar door was ajar and unguarded. Freedom. Just steps. Then Menyon turned. A shriek of terror escaped the mystic's lips as his eyes viewed the terrible look on the face of the Prince of Lee. Stenman clawed his way frantically toward the open doorway, stumbling blindly in the long red robes. He was only halfway up the steps when Menyon caught him. At the walls of Tirsis, the impossible was happening. Upon descending from the parapets of the outer wall, Balinor had moved quickly to the massive city gates. The legion guardsmen stationed before the great iron portals had snapped quickly to attention. Everything appeared to be as it should. The series of inner lock bolts, controlled mechanically from the tower gatehouse, had been run firmly into place in the crease where the gates swung outward. The cumbersome iron bar that served as an additional safeguard lay snugly in its fittings across the width of both gates. Balinor stared fixedly at the great wall, a nagging doubt persisting. Something was going to happen. He could feel it. The gates were the key to the city, the one weak link in the otherwise impenetrable stone wall that bound Tirsis. Siege towers, grappling hooks, scaling ladders, all these were futile attempts to breach that great wall, and the warlock lord had to know it. The gates were the key. His eyes drifted skyward to the tower gatehouse, a squat, windowless stone enclosure which housed the mechanism that controlled the inner locks. Two Legion soldiers stood attentively at the single door. A picked squad of men had been given the responsibility of protecting that crucial mechanism, men selected by Balinor and commanded by Captain Shelan. On both sides of the small housing, the men of the Border Legion defended the battlements. It seemed impossible that the Northlanders expected to seize the gatehouse. Still, already the tall borderman had moved to the foot of the narrow stairway that led to the gatehouse and had begun to climb the worn stone blocks. Sudden cries from the wall diverted his attention momentarily, and he paused as the air sounded with the deep humming of 1,000 bowstrings, and a rush of arrows swept the ramparts of the outer wall. Hurriedly, Balinor gained the battlements and in 3 short strides reached the wall. He peered carefully down at the face of the bluff, littered with bodies and debris, and dotted with small oil fires that burned hazily in the morning mist. The Northlanders had temporarily abandoned any direct assault. Instead, lines of archers 5 men deep were raking the defenders on the ramparts with a concentrated barrage. The reason for this new tactic was immediately obvious. At the rim of the bluff, a detachment of heavily armored rock trolls pushed forward a ponderous, mobile battering ram, shielded from the top and sides by a broad canopy of sheet iron. While the Border Legion was pinned down by heavy fire from the archers, the giant trolls would move the great ram into place before the city gates and force an entry. The plan appeared at first glance both preposterous and unworkable. Yet if the gatehouse fell to the enemy, the inner lock bolts could be released and only the long iron crossbar would hold the gates closed. The bar alone would not be enough to stand against the massive battering ram. Balinor ran toward the small gatehouse. The guards came silently to attention. He gave them a passing glance, his hand reaching anxiously for the door handle. Shelan was nowhere in sight. The door swung inward, and he was a step into the closed room when he realized he had never seen either of the sentries. The giant borderman reacted instinctively, sidestepping the noiseless rush of the guard behind him, seizing the outstretched lance that barely grazed his back and wrenching it free from the would-be assassin. His back to the wall, the king had only a moment to survey the dimly lighted room. The bodies of Shelan and his men lay to one side, twisted in death, their stiffened corpses stripped naked of armor and clothing. From out of the shadows at the rear of the housing, a group of faceless attackers rushed the borderman, daggers raised for the kill. Balinor threw the heavy lance crossways into their midst and broke for the open doorway. But the second sentry, who had remained just outside, saw him coming and quickly pulled the door shut from the other side. The trapped king had no time to force his way free. There was barely enough time to draw the great broadsword before his assailants were upon him. They bore him roughly to the floor, daggers chipping and glancing off the protective coat of chainmail that had saved his life so many times. With a mighty surge, Balinor shook himself free and regained his footing. In the faint light of the shuttered room, his attackers were only shadows, but his eyes were adjusting, and he cut at them as they moved toward him. 2 of the dark forms screamed and dropped lifelessly as the great blade cut through them, but their companions had already broken past the sweeping sword and closed with the king. For a second time, Balinor was wrestled down, but again he twisted free and the battle surged back across the little room. The din of the attack outside completely obscured the sounds of battle from within the stone housing. The borderman knew that unless he managed to get the door open, no one would come to his aid. He placed his back to the wall once more and swung the broadsword sharply as the shadowed enemies resumed the assault. Three were dead and several were wounded, but those who remained in the battle were beginning to wear him down with their repeated rushes. He had to get free quickly. Then an audible grinding of levers and gears filled the gatehouse, and he realized in horror that someone was releasing the inner lock bolts of the front gates. With a wild charge, he broke for the lock mechanism, but the determined attackers barred his path, and he was forced into a circling movement away from his objective. A moment later, there was a sharp grating of metal on metal, followed by a series of hammering blows. They were jamming the release levers. In complete disregard for his own safety, the infuriated Balinor threw himself on the remaining enemies. Then the gatehouse door burst open and the body of the traitorous sentry was thrust violently through the entryway. Gray daylight flooded the darkened room and the lean figure of Durin appeared from out of nowhere at the side of his friend. In grim silence, they cut away at the few enemy attackers who remained, forcing them away from the jammed machinery, away from the open doorway and escape, and into the far corner of the small housing. There, locked together in ferocious hand-to-hand combat, they destroyed them. Without a second glance at the dead men, the bloodied king rushed back to the damaged lock mechanism, his face lined in fury as he surveyed the twisted mass of metal levers and gears. Angrily, he threw his weight against the main release. It would not move. Durin turned pale as he realized what had happened. "We don't have enough time," Balinor exploded heatedly, wrenching violently at the jammed levers. A great booming crash resounded through the stone housing, vibrating through the walls and shaking the two men ominously. "The gates!" Durin exclaimed in dismay. A second crash rocked the gatehouse, and a third. The rushing of booted feet sounded on the ramparts outside, and a moment later, Messaline's dark face appeared in the open doorway. He started to speak, but Balinor was already issuing commands and moving toward the battlements. "Get this room cleared away and have our machinists try to free those gears. The gate locks are released and jammed." Messaline looked as if he had received a mortal blow. "Fortify the gates with timbers and put your best regiment in phalanx formation, 50 paces back and to either side. The Northlanders are not to break through. Put 2 lines of archers on the inner wall to bottle up the gate entrance. Reserves and the garrison command will defend the inner wall. All others will stay where they are at the outer wall. We will hold it as long as we can. If it falls, the Legion will retreat to the secondary defense and hold. If we lose that, we will regroup at the bridge of Sendik. That will be the last line of defense. Anything else?" Quickly, Durin explained where Hendel had gone. Balinor shook his head wearily. "We have been betrayed at every turn. Hendel will have to do what he can without our help for the moment. If the palace falls and they break through from the rear, we are finished anyway. Messaline, you'll hold the right flank of the phalanx. Jinison will take the left, and I'll be in the center. The enemy is not to break through. Pray that Eventine arrives before our strength fails us." Messaline disappeared outside in a crouching run. The shattering thrusts of the massive battering ram continued to shake the great wall as Balinor and Durin faced each other across the little room. Already the gray light of day was growing dimmer as the shadow of the warlock lord continued to roll ominously closer to the doomed city. The giant borderman reached out slowly and gripped the slim hand of his elven friend. "Goodbye, my friend. This is the end for us. Time has just about run out."
"Eventine would not willingly fail us," the elf began earnestly.
I know, Balinor replied. "Nor would Alanon. He has not found the sword or the heir of Shannara. His time
has run out as well." There was a brief silence between them, broken by the shouts of the men on the walls and the crashing of the ram against the gates of Tirsis. Balinor wiped the blood away from a deep cut over one eye. "Find your brother, Jiren. But before you leave the outer wall, have the last of the oil poured onto that ram and fired. If we can't stop them all together, we'll at least make it a hot place for them to work." He smiled grimly and slipped quietly out of the gatehouse. Jiren stared blankly after him, wondering what perverse fate had brought them to this unjust end. Balinor was the most remarkable man the elf had ever met. Yet he had lost everything. His family, his city, his home, and now his life was to be taken from him as well. What kind of world permitted such terrible injustice, where good men were stripped of everything, and soulless creatures of malice and hatred survived to glory in their pointless death? Once he had been so sure they would not fail, that somehow they would find a way to destroy the hated warlock lord and save the four lands. But that dream was ended. Jiren looked up dazedly as several burly legion machinists entered the gatehouse to begin their hopeless work on the jammed lock mechanism. Quickly the lean elf moved out onto the ramparts. It was time to find Dale. The struggle to hold the outer wall was incredibly vicious. Despite the devastating barrage concentrated against the men of the Border Legion by the lines of gnome archers below the bluff, the valiant defenders managed to cut away at the trolls that manned the great battering ram before the weakened gates. The remaining cauldrons of oil were moved to the fortifications above the ram and poured on the enemy machine and its handlers as they worked. Torches followed, and instantly the entire area was consumed in a mass of flames and rolling black smoke. Metal melted and smoldered, and the trolls were burned alive after the first few minutes of the terrible heat, their armor becoming a furnace they could not escape. But new enemy soldiers quickly filled the breach, and the mighty ram continued to break against the city gates in crashing, booming blows that first bent, then split the crossbar and the timbers that held the tall portals secure. The gray sky turned black from the oily smoke that rose above the burning grasslands to cloak the city walls and their defenders in a deep, murky haze. The smell of burnt flesh choked the nose and lungs of the legion soldiers as the charred, blackened bodies of the troll attackers lay in heaps before the outer wall. Desperately, the two opponents strove to break one another's strength, but the stalemate continued. For a short time, it seemed that the day might end without any further change in the fortunes of either army. But at last, the great crossbar snapped in two. The supporting timbers sagged and splintered, and the giant battering ram forced a breach in the gates of Tirsis. In a rush, the first Northlanders poured into the parade grounds and were dropped instantly by legion archers positioned atop the inner wall. Drawn up in a three-sided box opening toward the outer wall gates, the legion phalanx braced for the enemy rush, spears bristling through locked shields. The ram pushed forward and the gates opened further still, and then the foremost ranks of the Northland invasion force surged through the gap and threw themselves against the spears of the Border Legion. The Legion defenses wavered slightly, but held, thrusting the attackers backward, where they milled in confusion as they were cut to pieces by the archers on the walls, both above and behind them. In seconds, the parade ground was blanketed with Northland dead and wounded, and the breach in the gates had momentarily been bottled up so thoroughly that the great invasion forces could not advance farther. Durin had positioned himself next to the gatehouse on the outer wall, and from there he watched the Northland assault break apart on the Legion phalanx. He had discovered that his brother had gone with Janna Senpre to the palace, and reluctantly he decided to remain with Balinor for as long as possible. The enemy was attempting to regain its momentum now. On the plains below, Matarins directed the great rock troll commands toward the breach in the gates of the besieged city. The Northland army was calling on the backbone of its strength in a determined effort to crush the Southlanders once and for all. The outer wall was under attack again from all angles as hordes of gnomes and lesser trolls rushed forward with ladders, ropes, and grappling hooks. The thinned ranks of the Legion defenders who remained on the battlements fought desperately to prevent a breakthrough, but their men were dying, and the numbers of the Northland army seemed limitless. The battle was turning into a telling war of attrition that the men of Tirsis could not hope to win. Then, into the growing blackness of the sky north of the besieged city, two winged figures rose and hovered menacingly, and Durin felt his blood turn cold. Skullbearers. Were they so certain of victory that they dared reveal themselves in daylight? The elf felt his heart sink. He had done all he could here. It was time to join his brother. Whatever fate awaited them, they would at least face it together. Nimbly, he turned and moved along the wall in a crouching run until he was just behind the left flank of the Legion phalanx. A steep causeway led downward to the barracks grounds that lay between the walls of the city, several hundred feet behind the Legion rear lines. A deafening roar erupted from the men engaged in battle on the walls. As Durin neared the base of the rampway, he saw the tall, armored forms of the great rock trolls pouring through the breach in the gates of the outer wall. He paused involuntarily, sensing that the next few minutes would be crucial ones for the Border Legion. The phalanx tightened its formation and braced for the assault as the massive trolls drew up their ranks and moved slowly toward the center of the defensive line, where Balinor held command. 10 feet separated the combatants when, to everyone's surprise, the entire troll regiment wheeled abruptly to the left and charged directly into the Legion flank. There was a crunching sound as the two forces joined, and a terrific clash of metal as spear met mace and shield struck armor. For a moment the Legion phalanx held firmly, and the foremost of the giant trolls were killed and thrown down. But the superior strength and sheer weight of the Northlanders pressed back against the smaller men of the Border Legion, until at last the right end of the phalanx began to break apart. The commanding figure of Jinison moved quickly into the gap, his red hair flying as he fought to hold the line. The trolls were driven back step by step as Balinor closed on the right and Messaline from the rear. It was the most ferocious man-to-man combat Durin had been witness to in this terrible conflict, and he watched in awe as the great rock trolls held off the men of the Border Legion and once again pressed forward. An instant later, the breach in the phalanx was forced and Jinison disappeared from view entirely as a rush of massive attackers overwhelmed him and raced toward the barracks and the inner wall. Durin was directly in their path. There might have been time to gain the safety of the walls, but the elf was already on one knee, the ash bow armed and drawn back. The first troll fell at 50 paces, the second 10 closer, the third at 25. Legion soldiers from the wall rushed to the attack, and archers from the lesser heights of the inner wall tried desperately to halt the troll offensive. Everything in front of the elf was confusion as troll and legionnaire surged toward him, locked together in desperate hand-to-hand combat. Still, the massive Northlanders continued to come at him, and Durin fired the last of his arrows into their midst. He threw down the bow and for the first time thought about escape. But there was no time left, and he barely managed to seize a discarded sword before the surging mass of fighters was upon him. He struggled wildly to keep his balance as he was forced back against the barracks wall. A giant rock troll loomed directly over him, a black mass of bark-like skin and armor, and the elf twisted desperately to one side as a huge mace swung downward. He felt a blinding pain in his left shoulder, followed by a strange numbness. Grimly, he fought to stay conscious, his pain abruptly returning in a flood that racked his lean frame. But he was already falling. His face lay against the earth as he breathed in shallow gasps. A terrible heaviness pushed down on him as he felt the tide of the battle move beyond him. He tried to see, but the effort of looking was too great, and he slipped quietly into unconsciousness, through which pain still seemed to penetrate in great bursts. Menyon Lee bent his blood-streaked face over the body of Hendel and carefully raised the inert form in his arms. With studied, mechanical steps, he threaded his way through the bodies of their fallen enemies to reach the stairs and climbed slowly toward the open doorway, stepping carefully, but without looking, over the headless lump tangled in a loose mass of reddened robes that sprawled grotesquely across the center of the ancient stairway. Dazedly, the Highlander passed through the cellar entryway and moved down the vacant palace hall, gripping the lifeless form of the dwarf close to him. He walked aimlessly, his eyes shockingly blank, his face stricken with a terrible, stunned look that screamed in silent agony for release. He reached the palace foyer and there halted as the sound of running feet echoed hollowly from the eastern corridor. Gently, he laid his burden on the polished floor and stood quietly as the slim, Titian-haired girl slowed in front of him, sudden tears streaming down her beautiful face. "Oh, Menyon," she whispered faintly, "what have they done?" His eyes flickered and his mouth moved dumbly as he fought for the words that would not come. Quickly, Shirl reached for him, the slim arms coming tightly around his stooped frame, her face close to his own. A moment later, she felt his strong arms come around her shoulders, and the terrible agony trapped deep within him broke soundlessly and flooded over her to disappear in her silence and warmth. On the ramparts of the inner wall, Balinor completed a final check of the Legion defenses and paused wearily above the heavily barricaded gates. The Northlanders were already massing for a final rush. Just moments earlier, the impregnable outer wall had fallen, and the courageous soldiers of the Border Legion had been forced back to the second line of defense. Balinor stared grimly at the enemy swarming over the heights of the towering wall and gripped the hilt of his great broadsword until his knuckles turned white beneath the chainmail. His cloak and tunic had been shredded in the terrible combat to hold the breach in the gates of the outer wall against the troll assault. Balinor had held together the center of the Legion phalanx, but both wings had collapsed. Jinison had been killed. Messaline was severely wounded, and hundreds of Southlanders had died holding the outer wall until all hope was gone. Even Durin had disappeared in the fighting. Now the King of Calahorn stood alone. He gestured sharply to the men bracing the timbers that supported the gates below, the chainmail on his arm glinting brightly in the graying light, showing where a dozen blows had chipped and nicked the protective metal. For a moment he allowed his courage to give way entirely to despair. They had failed him. All of them. Eventine and the Elven army. Alanon. The whole Southland. Tirsis was on the brink of complete annihilation, and with it, the land of Calahorn, and still no one came to their aid. The Legion had fought alone to save them all. the final defense for the Southland. What purpose had it served? He caught himself quickly, roughly pushing down the doubts and despondency. There was no time to indulge himself. There were too many lives to be saved, and he was the one they depended upon. The Northland army was drawing up its lines along the base of the outer wall, the familiar scaling ladders, ropes, and grappling irons held ready for the assault. Already scattered bands of the massive rock trolls had scaled the inner wall during the battle on the parade grounds and broken into the city proper. He wondered briefly what had become of the reliable Hendel and Minyan Lee. Apparently they had secured the palace and prevented any rear assault, or the city would have already fallen. Now they would have to hold in the event isolated groups of the enemy breached the inner wall and broke for the palace. Bits of soot from the rolling clouds of oil smoke stung his eyes, and he rubbed them until they watered freely. Everything seemed masked in a heavy gray haze as he glanced quickly at the wall fortifications. The Legion had been placed in an impossible defensive position against an enemy so vast that the loss of hundreds from their ranks was insignificant. He thought of Hendel's words after the deaths of his father and brother. The last Buckhanna. The name would die with him, die as Tircis and her people died. The familiar roar rose in thunderous echoes from the throats of the Northlanders, and they charged recklessly for the Legion's walled defense. The long scar on the giant borderman's cheek turned a deeper shade of purple, and he brought the broadsword up menacingly. At almost the same moment, the first scattered remnants of the troll advance force came together at the foot of the Bridge of Sendik and hesitated. A line of determined Legion soldiers spanned the center of the wide stone arch, barring all passage to the home of the Buckhannas. Jonas Senpre stood foremost, flanked on one side by Minyan Lee, his battered frame erect as he gripped the sword of Lee with both hands, and on the other by Dale, his youthful face drawn but resolute. Behind the rock trolls, the air was thick with rolling smoke as fresh fires rose from the buildings of the city. Frightened cries sounded above the clamor of battle at the inner wall. In the distance, darting figures were seen scurrying across the deserted Tersian Way for the safety of their homes. Silently the forces faced one another, the number of trolls growing quickly as others appeared to swell their ranks. They studied the Southlanders with the blank, experienced look of professional soldiers, confident in the knowledge that they were the best-trained fighting unit in the world. The defenders on the bridge numbered less than 50. The afternoon sky had gone suddenly black, and an eerie stillness settled over the two armies. From somewhere in the burning city, Minyan caught the faint, clear cry of a small child. Several feet to his left, Dale felt the cold north wind fade with a low, sighing whisper. Before them, the giant trolls moved carefully into formation, the great maces held